6. The old woman, whose name was Aunt Talitha, led them through the town square and to the church with the leaning spire. It was the Church of the Blood Everlasting, according to the faded board on the Rundariot lawn. Written over the words, in green paint that had faded to a ghost, was another message. Death to Greys. She led them through the ruined church, hobbling rapidly along the center aisle, past the splintered and overturned pews, down a short flight of stairs, and into a kitchen so different from the ruin above that Susanna blinked in surprise. Here everything was neat as a pin. The wooden floor was very old, but it had been faithfully oiled and glowed with its own serene inner light. The black cook stove took up one whole corner. It was immaculate, and the wood stacked in the brick alcove next to it looked both well chosen and well seasoned. Their party had been joined by three more senior citizens, two women and a man who limped along on a crutch and a wooden leg. Two of the women went to the cupboards and began to make themselves busy. A third opened the belly of the stove and struck a long sulfur match to the wood already laid neatly within. A fourth opened another door and went down a short set of narrow steps into what looked like a cold pantry. Aunt Talitha, meanwhile, led the rest of them into a spacious entry at the rear of the church building. She waved her cane at two trestle tables which had been stored there under a clean but ragged dropcloth, and the two elderly albinos immediately went over and began to wrestle with one of them. "Come on, Jake," Eddie said. "Let's lend a hand."
"Stop," Aunt Talitha said briskly. "We may be old, but we don't need company to lend a hand. Not yet, youngster."
"Leave them be," Roland said. "Old fools will rupture themselves," Eddie muttered, but he followed the others, leaving the old men to their chosen table. Susanna gasped as Eddie lifted her from her chair and carried her through the back door. This wasn't a lawn, but a showplace, with beds of flowers blazing like torches in the soft green grass. She saw some she recognized, marigolds and zinnias and phlox, but many others were strange to her. As she watched, a horsefly landed on a bright blue petal, which at once folded over it and rolled up tight.
"Wow," Eddie said, staring around. "Bush gardens."
Si said, "This is the one place we keep the way it was in the old days, before the world moved on. And we keep it hidden from those who ride through, pubes, grays, harriers. They'd burn it if they knew, and kill us for keeping such a place. They hate anything nice, all of them. It's one thing all those bastards have in common."
The blind woman tugged his arm to shush him.
"No riders these days," the old man with the wooden leg said. "Not for a long time now. They keep closer into the city. Guess they find all they need to keep 'em well right there."
The albino twins struggled out with the table. One of the old women followed them, urging them to hurry up and get the hell out of her way. She held a stoneware pitcher in each hand.
"Sit ye down, gunslinger," Aunt Talitha cried, sweeping her hand at the grass. "Sit ye down, all."
Susanna could smell 100 conflicting perfumes. They made her feel dazed and unreal, as if this was a dream she was having. She could hardly believe this strange little pocket of Eden, carefully hidden behind the crumbling facade of the dead town. Another woman came out with a tray of glasses. They were mismatched, but spotless, twinkling in the sun like fine crystal. She held the tray out first to Roland, then to Aunt Talitha, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake at the last. As each took a glass, the first woman poured a dark golden liquid into it. Roland leaned over to Jake, who was sitting tailor-fashion near an oval bed of bright green flowers with Oi at his side. He murmured, "Drink only enough to be polite, Jake, or we'll be carrying you out of town. This is Graff, strong apple beer." Jake nodded. Talitha held up her glass, and when Roland followed suit, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake did the same.
"What about the others?" Eddie whispered to Roland. "They'll be served after the voluntary. Now be quiet."
"Will ye set us on with a word, gunslinger?" Aunt Talitha asked.
The gunslinger got to his feet, his glass upraised in his hand. He lowered his head as if in thought. The few remaining residents of River Crossing watched him respectfully, and Jake thought a little fearfully. At last he raised his head again.
"Will you drink to the earth, and to the days which have passed upon it?" he asked. His voice was hoarse, trembling with emotion. "Will you drink to the fullness which was, and to friends who have passed on? Will you drink to good company well met? Will these things set us on, old mother?" She was weeping, Jake saw, but her face broke into a smile of radiant happiness all the same, and for a moment she was almost young. Jake looked at her with wonder and sudden dawning happiness. For the first time since Eddie had hauled him through the door, he felt the shadow of the doorkeeper truly leave his heart.
"Aye, gunslinger," she said, "fair spoken. They'll set us on by the league, so they shall."
She tilted her glass up and drank it at a draught. When the glass was empty, Roland emptied his own. Eddie and Susanna also drank, although less deeply. Jake tasted his own drink and was surprised to find he liked it. The brew was not bitter, as he had expected, but both sweet and tart, like cider. He could feel the effects almost at once, however, and he put the glass carefully aside. Oi sniffed at it, then drew back and dropped his muzzle on Jake's ankle. Around them, the little company of old people, the last residents of River Crossing, were applauding. Most, like Aunt Talitha, were weeping openly. And now other glasses, not so fine but wholly serviceable, were passed around. The party began. And a fine party it was, on that long summer's afternoon beneath the wide prairie sky. 7. Eddie thought the meal he ate that day was the best he had had since the mythic birthday feasts of his childhood, when his mother had made it her business to serve everything he liked, meatloaf and roasted potatoes and corn on the cob and devil's food cake with vanilla ice cream on the side. The sheer variety of the edibles put before them, especially after the months they had spent eating nothing but lobster meat, deer meat, and a few bitter greens, which Roland pronounced safe, undoubtedly had something to do with the pleasure he took in the food. But Eddie didn't think that was the sole answer. He noticed that the kid was packing it away by the plateful and feeding a chunk of something to the bumbler crouched at his feet every couple of minutes, and Jake hadn't been here a week yet. There were bowls of stew, chunks of buffalo meat floating in a rich brown gravy loaded with vegetables, platters of fresh biscuits, crocks of sweet white butter, and bowls of leaves that looked like spinach but weren't exactly. Eddie had never been crazy about greens, but at the first taste of these, some deprived part of him awoke and cried for them. He ate well of everything, but his need for the green stuff approached greed, and he saw Susanna was also helping herself to them again and again. Among the four of them, the travelers emptied 3 bowls of the leaves. The dinner dishes were swept away by the old women and the albino twins. They returned with chunks of cake piled high on 2 thick white plates and a bowl of whipped cream. The cake gave off a sweetly fragrant smell that made Eddie feel as if he had died and gone to heaven.
"Only buffalo cream," Aunt Talitha said dismissively. "No more cows. Last one croaked 30 years ago. Buffalo cream ain't no prize winner, but better nothing but Daisy."
The cake turned out to be loaded with blueberries. Eddie thought it beat by a country mile any cake he'd ever had. He finished 3 pieces, leaned back, and belched ringingly before he could clap a hand over his mouth. He looked around guiltily. Mercy, the blind woman, cackled.
"I heard that. Someone be thanking the cook, Auntie."
"Aye," Aunt Talitha said, laughing herself,
"so we do."
The 2 women who had served the food were returning yet again. One carried a steaming jug. The other had a number of thick ceramic cups balanced precariously on her tray. Aunt Talitha was sitting at the head of the table with Roland by her right hand. Now he leaned over and murmured something in her ear. She listened, her smile fading a little, then nodded.
"Si, Bill, and Till," she said, "you 3 stay. We are going to have us a little palaver with this gunslinger and his friends, on account of they mean to move along this very afternoon. The rest of you take your coffee in the kitchen, and so cut down the babble. Mind you make your manners before you go."
Bill and Till, the albino twins, remained sitting at the foot of the table. The others formed a line and moved slowly past the travelers. Each of them shook hands with Eddie and Susanna, then kissed Jake on the cheek.
The boy accepted this with good grace, but Eddie could see he was both surprised and embarrassed. When they reached Roland, they knelt before him and touched the sandalwood butt of the revolver which jutted from the holster he wore on his left hip. He put his hands on their shoulders and kissed their old brows. Mercy was the last. She flung her arms around Roland's waist and baptized his cheek with a wet, ringing kiss.
"God's bless and keep ye, gunslinger, if only I could see ye. Mind your manners, Mercy,"
Aunt Talitha said sharply. But Roland ignored her and bent over the blind woman. He took her hands gently but firmly in his own and raised them to his face. "See me with these, beauty," he said, and closed his eyes as her fingers, wrinkled and misshapen with arthritis, patted gently over his brow, his cheeks, his lips, and chin.
"Aye, gunslinger,"
she breathed, lifting the sightless sockets of her eyes to his faded blue ones.
"I see you very well. 'Tis a good face, but full of sadness and care. I fear for you and yours."
"Yet we are well met, are we not?" he asked, and planted a gentle kiss on the smooth, worn skin of her forehead.
"Aye, so we are, so we are. Thank ye for your kiss, gunslinger. From my heart I thank ye."
"Go on, Mercy," Aunt Talitha said in a gentler voice. "Get your coffee."
Mercy rose to her feet. The old man with the crutch and peg leg guided her hand to the waistband of his pants. She seized it and, with a final salute to Roland and his band, allowed him to lead her away. Eddie wiped at his eyes, which were wet. "Who blinded her?" he asked hoarsely.
"Harriers," Aunt Talitha said. "Did it with a branding iron, they did. Said it was because she was looking at him pert. 25 years agone, that was. Drink your coffee now, all of you. It's nasty when it's hot, but it ain't nothing but road mud once it's cold."
Eddie lifted the cup to his mouth and sipped experimentally. He wouldn't have gone so far as to call it road mud, but it wasn't exactly Blue Mountain blend either. Susanna tasted hers and looked amazed.
"Why, this is chicory."
Talitha glanced at her.
"I know it not. Docky is all I know, and Docky coffee's all we've had since I had the woman's curse, and that curse was lifted from me long, long ago."
"How old are you, ma'am?"
Jake asked suddenly. Aunt Talitha looked at him, surprised, then cackled.
"In truth, lad, I disremember. I recall sitting in this same place and having a party to celebrate my 80, but there were over 50 people sitting out on this lawn that day, and Mercy still had her eyes."
Her own eyes dropped to the bumbler lying at Jake's feet. Oi didn't remove his muzzle from Jake's ankle, but he raised his gold-ringed eyes to gaze at her.
"A Billy Bumbler, b'daisy. It's been long and long since I've seen a bumbler in company with people. Seems they've lost the memory of the days when they walked with men."
One of the albino twins bent down to pat Oi. Oi pulled away from him.
"Once they used to herd sheep,"
Bill, or perhaps it was Till, said to Jake.
"Did you know that, youngster?"
Jake shook his head.
"Do he talk?" the albino asked. "Some did in old days."
"Yes, he does."
He looked down at the bumbler, who had returned his head to Jake's ankle as soon as the strange hand left his general area.
"Say your name, Oi."
Oi only looked up at him.
"Oi,"
Jake urged, but Oi was silent. Jake looked at Aunt Talitha and the twins, mildly chagrined.
"Well, he does, but I guess he only does it when he wants to."
"That boy doesn't look as if he belongs here," Aunt Talitha said to Roland. "His clothes are strange. And his eyes are strange as well."
"He hasn't been here long." Roland smiled at Jake, and Jake smiled uncertainly back. "In a month or two, no one will be able to see his strangeness."
"Aye? I wonder, so I do. And where does he come from?"
"Far from here," the gunslinger said. "Very far." She nodded.
"And when will he go back?"
"Never," Jake said. "This is my home now."
"God's pity you, then," she said, "for the sun is going down on the world. It's going down forever.
At that, Susanna stirred uneasily. One hand went to her belly as if her stomach was upset. "Suze?" Eddie asked. "You all right?" She tried to smile, but it was a weak effort. Her normal confidence and self-possession seemed to have temporarily deserted her.
"Yes, of course. A goose walked over my grave, that's all."
Aunt Talitha gave her a long, assessing look that seemed to make Susanna uncomfortable, and then smiled.
"A goose on my grave? Ha! I haven't heard that one in donkey's years."
"My dad used to say it all the time."
Susanna smiled at Eddie, a stronger smile this time.
"And anyway, whatever it was is gone now. I'm fine."
"What do you know about the city and the lands between here and there?" Roland asked, picking up his coffee cup and sipping. "Are there harriers? And who are these others, these grays and pubes?" Aunt Talitha sighed deeply. 8.
"Ye'd hear much, gunslinger, and we know but little. One thing I do know is this: the city's an evil place, especially for this youngster, any youngster. Is there any way you can steer around it as you go your course?"
Roland looked up and observed the now familiar shape of the clouds as they flowed along the path of the beam. In this wide, plain sky, that shape, like a river in the sky, was impossible to miss. "Perhaps," he said at last, but his voice was oddly reluctant. "I suppose we could skirt around Ludd to the southwest and pick up the beam on the far side."
"It's the beam you follow," she said. I thought so."
Eddie found his own consideration of the city colored by the steadily strengthening hope that when and if they got there, they would find help. Abandoned goodies which would aid them in their quest, or maybe even some people who could tell them a little more about the Dark Tower and what they were supposed to do when they got there. The ones called the Greys, for instance, they sounded like the sort of wise old elves he kept imagining. The drums were creepy, true enough, reminding him of 100 low-budget jungle epics, mostly watched on TV with Henry by his side and a bowl of popcorn between them, where the fabulous lost cities the explorers had come looking for were in ruins, and the natives had degenerated into tribes of bloodthirsty cannibals. But Eddie found it impossible to believe something like that could have happened in a city that looked, at least from a distance, so much like New York. If there were not wise old elves or abandoned goodies, there would surely be books, at least. He had listened to Roland talk about how rare paper was here, but every city Eddie had ever been in was absolutely drowning in books. They might even find some working transportation. The equivalent of a Land Rover would be nice. That was probably just a silly dream, but when you had thousands of miles of unknown territory to cover, a few silly dreams were undoubtedly in order, if only to keep your spirits up. And weren't those things at least possible, damn it? He opened his mouth to say some of these things, but Jake spoke before he could.
"I don't think we can go around," he said,
and then blushed a little when they all turned to look at him. Oi shifted at his feet.
"No?" Aunt Talitha said. "And why do you think that, pray tell?"
"Do you know about trains?" Jake asked.
There was a long silence. Bill and Till exchanged an uneasy glance. Aunt Talitha only looked at Jake steadily. Jake did not drop his eyes.
"I heard one," she said. "Mayhap even saw it. Over there."
She pointed in the direction of the Send.
"Long ago, when I was but a child, and the world hadn't moved on, or at least not so far as it has now. Is it Blaine you speak of, boy?"
Jake's eyes flashed in surprise and recognition.
"Yes, Blaine!"
Roland was studying Jake closely.
"And how would ye know of Blaine the Mono?" Aunt Talitha asked.
"Mono?"
Jake looked blank.
"Aye, so it was called. How would you know of that old lay?"
Jake looked helplessly at Roland, then back at Aunt Talitha.
"I don't know how I know."
And that's the truth, Eddie thought suddenly. But it's not all the truth. He knows more than he wants to tell here, and I think he's scared. "This is our business, I think," Roland said in a dry, brisk administrator's voice. "You must let us work it out for ourselves, old mother."
"Aye," she agreed quickly. "You'll keep your own counsel. Best that such as us not know."
"What of the city?" Roland prompted. "What do you know of Ludd?"
"Little, now, but what we know ye shall hear."
And she poured herself another cup of coffee. 9. It was the twins, Bill and Till, who actually did most of the talking, one taking up the tale smoothly whenever the other left off. Every now and then, Aunt Talitha would add something or correct something, and the twins would wait respectfully until they were sure she was done. Si didn't speak at all, merely sat with his untouched coffee in front of him, plucking at the pieces of straw which bristled up from the wide brim of his sombrero. They knew little indeed, Roland realized quickly, even about the history of their own town. Nor did this surprise him. In these latter days, memories faded rapidly, and all but the most recent past seemed not to exist. But what they did know was disturbing. Roland was not surprised by this, either. In the days of their great-great-grandparents, River Crossing had been much the town Susanna had imagined. A trade stop at the Great Road, modestly prosperous, a place where goods were sometimes sold, but more often exchanged. It had been at least nominally part of River Barony, although even then such things as baronies and estates of land had been passing. There had been buffalo hunters in those days, although the trade had been dying out. The herds were small and badly mutated. The meat of these mutant beasts was not poison, but it had been rank and bitter. Yet River Crossing, located between a place they simply called The Landing and the village of Jimtown, had been a place of some note. It was on the Great Road, and only 6 days' travel from the city by land and 3 by barge.
"Unless the river were low," one of the twins said. "Then it took longer, and my granddad said there was times when there was barges grounded all the way up river to Tom's Neck."
The old people knew nothing of the city's original residents, of course, or the technologies they had used to build the towers and turrets. These were the great old ones, and their history had been lost in the furthest reaches of the past, even when Aunt Talitha's great-great-grandfather had been a boy.
"The buildings are still standing," Eddie said. "I wonder if the machines the great golden oldies used to build them still run."
"Mayhap," one of the twins said. "If so, young feller, there don't be any man or woman that lives there now who'd still know how to run 'em. Or so I believe, so I do."
"Nay," his brother said argumentatively, "I doubt the old ways are entirely lost to the greys and pubes even now."
He looked at Eddie.
"Our dad said there was once electric candles in the city. There are those who say them out still burn."
"Imagine that," Eddie replied wonderingly, and Susanna pinched his leg hard under the table.
"Yes," the other twin said. He spoke seriously, unaware of Eddie's sarcasm. "You pushed a button and they came on. Bright, heatless candles with airy wicks or reservoirs for oil. And I've heard it said that once, in the old days, Quick, the outlaw prince, actually flew up into the sky in a mechanical bird. But one of its wings broke, and he died in a great fall like Icarus."
Susanna's mouth dropped open. "You know the story of Icarus?"
"Aye, lady," he said, clearly surprised she should find this strange. "He of the beeswax wings." "Children's stories, both of them," Aunt Talitha said with a sniff. "I know the story of the endless lights is true, for I saw them with my own eyes when I was but a green girl, and they may still glow from time to time. Aye, there are those I trust who say they've seen them on clear nights, although it's been long years since I have myself. But no man ever flew, not even the great old ones."
Nonetheless, there were strange machines in the city, built to do peculiar and sometimes dangerous things. Many of them might still run, but the elderly twins reckoned that none now in the city knew how to start them up, for they hadn't been heard in years.
"Maybe that could change, though," Eddie thought, his eyes gleaming. "If that is an enterprising, travel-minded young man with a little knowledge of strange machinery and endless lights came along, it could be just a matter of finding the on switches. I mean, it really could be that simple. Or maybe they just blew a bunch of fuses. Think of that, friends and neighbors. Just replace half a dozen 400-amp buses and light the whole place up like a Reno Saturday night."
Susanna elbowed him and asked in a low voice what was so funny. Eddie shook his head and put a finger to his lips, earning an irritated look from the love of his life. The albinos, meanwhile, were continuing their story, handing its thread back and forth with the unconscious ease which probably nothing but lifetime twinship can provide. 4 or 5 generations ago, they said, the city had still been quite heavily populated and reasonably civilized, although the residents drove wagons and buckboards along the wide boulevards the great old ones had constructed for their fabulous horseless vehicles. The city dwellers were artisans and what the twins called manufactories, and trade both on the river and over it had been brisk. "Over it?" Roland asked.
"The bridge over the Seine still stands," Aunt Talitha said, "or did 20 years ago." "Aye, old Bill Muffin and his boy saw it not 10 years agone," Si agreed, making his first contribution to the conversation.
"What sort of bridge?" the gunslinger asked.
"A great thing of steel cables," one of the twins said. "It stands in the sky like the web of some great spider," he added shyly. "I should like to see it again before I die." "Probably fallen in by now," Aunt Talitha said dismissively, "and good riddance, devil's work."
She turned to the twins.
"Tell them what's happened since, and why the city's so dangerous now, apart from any haunts that may den there, that is, and I'll warrant there's a power of 'em. These folks want to get on, and the sun's on the wester."
10. The rest of the story was but another version of a tale Roland of Gilead had heard many times, and had in some measure lived through himself. It was fragmentary and incomplete, undoubtedly shot through with myth and misinformation, its linear progress distorted by the odd changes, both temporal and directional, which were now taking place in the world, and it could be summed up in a single compound sentence. "Once there was a world we knew, but that world has moved on." These old people of River Crossing knew of Gilead no more than Roland knew of the River Barony. And the name of John Farson, the man who had brought ruin and anarchy on Roland's land, meant nothing to them. But all stories of the old world's passing were similar. Too similar, Roland thought, to be coincidence. A great civil war, perhaps in Garland, perhaps in a more distant land called Porla, had erupted 300, perhaps even 400 years ago. Its ripples had spread slowly outward, pushing anarchy and dissension ahead of them. Few, if any, kingdoms had been able to stand against those slow waves, and anarchy had come to this part of the world as surely as night follows sunset. At one time, whole armies had been on the roads, sometimes in advance, sometimes in retreat, always confused and without long-term goals. As time passed, they crumbled into smaller groups, and these degenerated into roving bands of harriers. Trade faltered, then broke down entirely. Travel went from a matter of inconvenience to one of danger. In the end, it became almost impossible. Communication with the city thinned steadily and had all but ceased 120 years ago. Like 100 other towns Roland had ridden through, first with Cuthbert and the other gunslingers cast out of Gilead, then alone in pursuit of the man in black, River Crossing had been cut off and thrown on its own resources. At this point, Si roused himself, and his voice captured the travelers at once. He spoke in the hoarse, cadenced tones of a lifelong teller of tales, one of those divine fools born to merge memory and mendacity into dreams as airily gorgeous as cobwebs strung with drops of dew.
"We last sent tribute to the Barony Castle in the time of my great-grandad," he said. 26 men went, with a wagon of hides. There was no hard coin any more by then, of course, and 'twas the best they could do. It was a long and dangerous journey of almost 80 wheels, and 6 died on the way. Half fell to harriers bound for the war in the city, the other half died either of disease or devil grass. When they finally arrived, they found the castle deserted, but for the rooks and blackbirds. The walls had been broken,
weeds o'ergrew the court estate. There'd been a great slaughter on the fields to the west. It were white with bones and red with rusty armor, so my dad's granddad said. And the voices of demons cried out like the east wind from the jawbones of those who'd fallen there. A village beyond the castle had been burned to the ground, and 1,000 or more skulls were posted along the walls of the keep. Our folk left their bounty of hides without the shattered barbican gate, for none would venture inside that place of ghosts and moaning voices, and began the homeward way again. 10 more fell on that journey, so that of the 26 who left, only 10 returned. My great-granddad, one of them. But he picked up a ringworm on his neck and bosom that never left until the day he died. It were the radiation sickness, or so they said. After that, gunslinger, none left the town. We were on our own.
They grew used to the depredations of the harriers, Cy continued in his cracked but melodious voice. Watches were posted. When bands of riders were seen approaching, almost always moving southeast along the great road and the path of the beam, going to the war which raged endlessly in Ludd, the townspeople hid in a large shelter they had dug beneath the church. Casual damages to the town were not repaired, lest they make those roving bands curious. Most were beyond curiosity. They only rode through at a gallop, bows or battle axes slung over their shoulders, bound for the killing zones. "What war is it that you speak of?" Roland asked. "Yes," Eddie said, "and what about that drumming sound?" The twins again exchanged a quick, almost superstitious glance.
"We know not of the god drums," Cy told them, "merry word or watch. The war of the city, now."
The war had originally been the harriers and outlaws against a loose confederation of artisans and manufactories who lived in the city. The residents had decided to fight instead of allowing the harriers to loot them, burn their shops, and then turn the survivors out into the big empty, where they would almost certainly die. And for some years they had successfully defended Ludd against the vicious but badly organized groups of raiders which tried to storm across the bridge or invade by boat and barge.
"The city folk used old weapons," one of the twins said, "and though their numbers were small, the harriers could not stand against such things with their bows and maces and battle axes."
"Do you mean the city people used guns?" Eddie asked. One of the albinos nodded.
"Aye, guns. But not just guns. There were things that hurled the firebangs over a mile or more. Explosions like dynamite, only more powerful. The outlaws, who are now the Greys, as you must ken, could do nothing but lay siege beyond the river, and that was what they did."
Ludd became, in effect, the last fortress refuge of the latter world. The brightest and most able traveled there from the surrounding countryside by ones and twos. When it came to intelligence tests, sneaking through the tangled encampments and front lines of the besiegers was the newcomer's final exam. Most came unarmed across the no-man's land of the bridge, and those who made it that far were let through. Some were found wanting and sent packing again, of course, but those who had a trade or a skill or brains enough to learn one were allowed to stay. Farming skills were particularly prized. According to the stories, every large park in Ludd had been turned into a vegetable garden. With the countryside cut off, it was grow food in the city or starve amid the glass towers and metal alleys. The great old ones were gone, their machines were a mystery, and the silent wonders which remained were inedible. Little by little, the character of the war began to change. The balance of power had shifted to the besieging Greys, so-called because they were, on average, much older than the city dwellers. Those latter were also growing older, of course. They were still known as pubes, but in most cases their puberty was long behind them. And they eventually either forgot how the old weapons worked or used them up.
"Probably both," Roland grunted.
Some 90 years ago, within the lifetimes of Cy and Aunt Talitha, a final band of outlaws had appeared, one so large that the outriders had gone galloping through river crossing at dawn, and the drogues did not pass until almost sundown. It was the last army these parts had ever seen, and it was led by a warrior prince named David Quick. the same fellow who supposedly later fell to his death from the sky. He had organized the raggle-taggle remnants of the outlaw bands which still hung about the city, killing anyone who showed opposition to his plans. Quick's army of Greys used neither boat nor bridge to attempt entry into the city, but instead built a pontoon bridge 12 miles below it and attacked on the flank.
"Since then the war has guttered like a chimney fire," Aunt Talitha finished. "We hear reports every now and then from someone who's managed to leave. Aye, so we do. These come a little more often now, for the bridge, they say, is undefended, and I think the fire is almost out. Within the city, the Pubes and Greys squabble over the remaining spoils, only I reckon that the descendants of the Harriers who followed Quick over the pontoon bridge are the real Pubes now, although they are still called Greys. The descendants of the original city dwellers must now be almost as old as we are, although there are still some Yunkers who go to be among them, drawn by the old stories and the lure of the knowledge which may still remain there. These two sides still keep up their old enmity, gunslinger, and both would desire this young man you call Eddie. If the dark-skinned woman is fertile, they would not kill her even though her legs are short-ended. They would keep her to bear children, for children are fewer now, and although the old sicknesses are passing, some are still born strange."
At this, Susanna stirred, seemed about to say something, then only drank the last of her coffee and settled back into her former listening position.
"But if they would desire the young man and woman, gunslinger, I think they would lust for the boy."
Jake bent and began to stroke Oi's fur again. Roland saw his face and knew what he was thinking. It was the passage under the mountains all over again, just another version of the slow mutants.
"You, they'd just as soon kill," Aunt Talitha said, "for you are a gunslinger, a man out of his own time and place, neither fish nor fowl, and no use to either side. But a boy can be taken, used, schooled to remember some things and to forget all the others. They've all forgotten whatever it was they had to fight about in the first place. The world has moved on since then. Now they just fight to the sound of them awful drumbeats, some few still young, most of them old enough for the rocking chair like us here, all of them stupid grots who only live to kill and kill to live."
She paused.
"Now that you've heard us old cullies to the end, are you sure it would not be best to go around and leave them to their business?"
Before Roland could reply, Jake spoke up in a clear, firm voice. "Tell what you know about Blaine the Mono," he said. "Tell about Blaine and Engineer Bob."